Okay, good evening, everybody. We're reconvening on our A to Z. Good evening. Hi there.
I just want to welcome everyone and thank Yaffa and Jack for sponsoring tonight's class. Oh. And if anyone is interested or able to sponsor future classes, please speak to me, because we would love to continue this in strength.
We're getting to the challenging letters of the alphabet. Q, X, Z, or as I call it, Z, as I call it. So I'm working a bit hard on trying to get to even the next one. Q is going to be Queen and Country. I apologize, reference to the Queen, but nothing I can do about it. It's about monarchy. It's the flip side of Mashiach. It's a bit more of the history and the background and things that we've suffered from because of our relationship to kings and queens, and mainly kings, not so much queens. So we'll talk about that. The only mistake I made on the schedule was that Wednesday, 28th of February, is Purim. Turns out that's Purim. So there won't be a shiur that week because we'll all be in celebratory mode. Otherwise, hopefully we won't get quite through to Z. We'll get to V, I think. Talk about the veggies, vegetarians, vegans, and all the rest of that, which is also interesting. We'll try to get through to that. The shiur I'm preparing at the moment is on ugliness. Very, very interesting shiur, because it's something that people don't talk about, and it's got a lot of issues, and wow, there's some amazing sources. One of the things I just want to mention as an introduction to these to the shiurim is that I'm not here to just give you platitudes and sort of, you know, sound bites. I think the thing I'm really happy about these shiurim, I'm excited about these shiurim, is that you've got sources. You actually come out with material, right? And you're seeing Gemaras, you're seeing references in Torah, you're seeing references in responsa. This is the real deal. This is coming from, again, I have to just put it on the record that these shiurim are based on a lot of stuff that was taught at YU over the years, University, and was collated by a gentleman called Nachum Amzel. He's a rabbi in Israel. And we made the connection there. Wonderful gentleman. I met him a few years ago in Israel. We were there for Sukkot, and we bumped into each other. His work is outstanding, and he's brought together all of these sources. So I'm very grateful to him for that, because what I've done is sort of worked it through and tried to give sort of beef up what he's actually saying. This evening's diet is about prejudice, and prejudice is one of these topics which not easy to talk about. Prejudice by Jews. I had a very interesting experience. I gave this shiur to what I call my summer camp group. I go to a summer camp every year. We have been going now for about 15 years. It's an elder hostel. The average age is around 80, and a wonderful group. But when you start talking about prejudice, it's very, very interesting, their reaction. I'm not talking about prejudice in general, but here I'm specifically interested in prejudice by Jews. Not prejudice suffering from prejudice, that I don't even have to talk about, that's something that we've always suffered from. But in terms of us as a group of people, is there any circumstance where we can actually be prejudicial? All right. Are we allowed to be? Is this something that is referred to in the sources? And, you know, there's kind of an obvious thing to talk about, which is going to be the ger. We're going to come to that in a few minutes. The word ger is going to be, I think, a bit surprising. This, I think, is the chidush. This is the novelty of this particular shiur. Just by way of definition, prejudice, the word prejudice, I've written it here at the beginning, comes from two words, prejudge. Right? So prejudice, by definition, is to prejudge, to judge before the event. All right. If you are making, as I wrote here, it can be a positive generalization, but it's still prejudice. All Jews are smart. All right, or whatever. So what some people, all Jews are rich. That's my wife suffered from that comment once upon a time. It's an interesting story, but yeah, that's definitely not true. Oh boy, I wish it was true, but it really isn't. And of course, we don't have to go very far. I want to sort of keep in the background the fact that January 27th is Holocaust Remembrance Day. Not Yom HaShoah in Israel, but it's around the world. And it's the day when Auschwitz was liberated, and there are a lot of memorials going on, certainly at the Holocaust Museum in New York, the one in Washington, and various places around the world. So, you know, we'll come back to maybe talk about this, link this whole presentation to that towards the end. So what we're going to initially decide is, in essence, is what I've got in the first paragraph. Prejudice, prejudge, right? Is it prejudicial to talk about something after the fact? The answer is absolutely not. You know, we may come to certain conclusions after we have a certain amount of information, a certain amount of evidence, and that is not necessarily what we are referring to here. Here is judging essentially before the fact, before we get some sort of interaction, as we'll see later on. There are certain groups of people that we are, how should we say, we're encouraged to be prejudicial towards. And it may come as a bit of a surprise. I don't think it will. I mean, I don't have to say Amalek, but there are other groups as well, which, by definition, we have to be very careful of. We have to be very suspicious of, I would say. But it's not. The evidence is going to be so much against being prejudicial that it's almost challenging, beyond belief, to try and find a case where you can be prejudicial. You know, Judaism is very concerned with the situation of the rights of the person, the integrity of the person, what we call kavod abriyot, the whole idea of human dignity. This is something which is the essence of what it is to be Jewish. At least that's according to the Talmud. I look around the Jewish world today, I'm not quite sure whether it's that or, you know, how kosher the item is becoming to the point where you've got no room left for all the hechsherim because, you know, there's no room left on the label. That seems to be the Judaism of the 21st century. It's whatever. I'm not going to go there again, but I've been there in these shurim before. Have a look at some of these sources because they are really, really interesting. The first source is Gemara Bar Mitzvah. It's in the middle of the page. And what I'm going to show you is generally the attitude against being prejudicial, right? Prejudging. We're just told this is not what we are supposed to do. And the example that we go for, as I said before, is the example of the ger, right? We'll define what a ger is eventually. It's not, I mean, obviously ger means someone who converts, but it's more than that. The Torah definition of the word ger is much more encompassing than the limited definition of what we would think it means. And I'll just show you here, this statement of the Talmud. I brought the whole thing, but it's literally the last two lines of that quote in the middle of page one. Tanya Rabbi Elazar Gadol Omer, Rabbi Elazar Gadol, one of the great rabbis of his generation, he said, Mipnei Ma Yizirat Torah, he just gives us the number of times that the Torah warns us not to afflict the ger, the stranger. And he says, some say shloshim v'shisha mekomo, 36 times. 36 times. Wow. I mean, there's almost nothing else except for idolatry, which is mentioned that many times in the Torah. For Amri lo, some say barbe'im v'shisha mekomo, 46 times. He doesn't actually list all the places. I tried to find some of these references here. And you've got underneath there, shmot, Vayikrov, Devarim, I mean, goes on and on. Look at these psukim, we know these psukim. I'll just read them very quickly. This is the references from Shmot and Vayikra and Devarim. It's Ger lo toneh ve lo tichatzenu, do not oppress the stranger. Ki gerim hayitem beris Mitzrayim. That's a bit of a clue. You were strangers in the land of Egypt. And again, it goes on, kol amana v'yatom lo ta'anun, do not afflict the widow or the orphan, and we're going to talk about the connection, but in terms of why the Torah puts these two items together, the two psukim, one about the ger and then one about the widow, and imane tane oto ki im tsaoki tzakelai, because if you do it and he cries to me, meaning Hashem says the person is being afflicted cries to God, it says shomai eshma tzakoto, I will hear his cry. So this is something that we are warned, this is really not to be done. And it goes on, and the various psukim, the last one here, kiyomuch achicha, if your brother becomes impoverished, mota yodoima, and he's looking for some assistance, zaktabo, geva toshav v'chayimoch, then the person who is living amongst you, one has to support. And of course the question is, as we're saying here, what are we referring to? Are we referring to converts? Are we referring to the classic definition of someone who converts to Judaism? You know, it's talking here, Gerim, Hayitem, Be'eres Mitzrayim. It's not talking about we were all converts in the land of Egypt. We're going through all the stories at the moment in the Torah reading. We weren't converted over there. We would be, on the contrary, we remained separate. That's one of the incredible things about it. A lot to say about that, but that's a parsha show, that's for another time. But the reality is, the word ger has got a very wide range of meaning. If you just turn over the page, and I'll just show you this very, very, really interesting thing. The Sefer Achinuch, when he talks about this mitzvah on page 2, this is the other side of the page that I just gave you, and he, Sefer Achinuch, again, to explain the book written by Rabbi Aaron of Barcelona, we don't know his surname, Aaron, whatever, maybe, I don't know, Cohen, I don't know what his name was, and it's the book where he lists all the mitzvot, and he tries to give shorashim, roots, which really means reasons. He tries to give reasons. The Rambam started it. And in that period of time, in the Middle Ages, they all the big rabbis were looking for rational explanations for many of the mitzvot. Not for all of the mitzvot. Some are obviously chukim, but there are a lot of mitzvot which have a rationale. And this was the game of the day to try and work it out. So he says over here, Mishrashei HaMitzvah, I'll just read the Hebrew. He says that the root of the mitzvah, one of the reasons, that we should, as it were, subdue us, in other words, to look after the person who is less fortunate than us, is something which is really important. It's subjugating our yetzer, our inclination. So that we won't act badly towards that particular person. Take advantage of the person. Al-Kain. That's why it refers to a person who's amongst us, who's without any support. Remember, this is before the welfare state, as they call it in England, or the national, I don't know what you call it over here, I suppose, you know, sort of different agencies that are there to help through government and through private agencies. This was before all of that was going on. This was back in the Middle Ages. But he says, people are vulnerable. The weaker members of society. Basically, what he's saying is that we should not in any way take advantage of the less fortunate person in a negative way. And I'm reading this, and I'm reading. I don't know if any of you saw this. There's a story going on in Israel which has sort of got slightly annulled, slightly pushed to the side, but it's a very serious problem. That in the 80s and 90s, there was a, particularly I think in the 90s, there was a move to bring foreign workers to Israel. Now, I know my father-in-law, when he was alive, a lot of people have this arrangement, this wonderful Hebrew word, Filipino, right? You always ask about the Filipino because they're the Philippine. Both men and women are incredibly good carers. They really do a fantastic job, and they're in Israel really in large numbers. They've come there, and they even speak Hebrew. I mean, they've made a tremendous effort to try and integrate them, but they're not Jewish. So the problem is, what do you do, not just with the people who came to work, but now they're having families, and you know the children are going to school, etc. How do you deal with foreign workers, and even more so, there are people coming in from Africa who are not doing care work, but they're doing building work, I guess. They're coming in from all different African countries, and there's an issue there. And it's kind of distressing in a way, because I think only recently, I think Prime Minister Netanyahu, there was a bill, some of you will know, maybe you can sort of enlighten me on this.
Money to a ticket and
ticket to go back, right?
To go back.
Yeah, and to pay to go back. And again, you ask yourself, you know, am I comfortable with this particular situation? You know, what are we dealing with here? And you can see that you may very well have to sort of incorporate the Jewish value of caring for the person who is the weaker member of society. All right? Now, I'm not going to go into the whole discussion over here with immigration, which is sort of really the hot number at the moment and everything that's going on. But there is clearly an issue as far as we're concerned from Jewish values, from Jewish point of view. We've got to think about that weaker person in society, and certainly not to take advantage. I've just wrote a little summary here. The mitzvah is to teach us not to think evil about the most helpless and defenseless in our society. The non-Jewish stranger is an easy target. Again, we're not talking about Jews here. We're talking about non-Jews who are within our society. Like in Israel today, we've got very large group. I think in South Tel Aviv or North Tel Aviv, there's a very big community. African community. It's by Tikva. Yeah, it's really amazing. And what's going on there. And the whole integration or lack of integration, really, in many ways, and the problem of how to deal with that element, and it becomes a point of, I would say, not just for the modern state of Israel in terms of secular values, but I think Jewish values should come into this as well. So here you've got the non-Jewish stranger, an easy target, cannot fight back if in such a minority. He becomes us a moral barometer, and we treat him or her well, for then we are surely treating the rest of society in a positive way as well. We develop a total sense of feeling kind to all people in society. This is essentially what the Chinuch says. And this is the reason for repetition of the basic concept. So, you know, this is what it's about. And the next comment here is just on that pasuk, where I mentioned before that the idea of not oppressing the non-Jew, the ger, which we're now going to call the stranger. I'm not going to call it the convert. We'll talk about converts maybe as well. But we're talking about generally the non-Jew living within a Jewish society. And this could be, as I said today, this is a real issue in Israel. And the Torah puts that prohibition against oppressing such a person next to the prohibition of taking advantage of the widow and the orphan. Again, people who are the weaker elements of society. And again, what it says here is quite clear. That, again, I wrote it here, the treatment of the stranger is linked to the widow and the orphan, who are also weaker members of society. Easy targets and need extra protection against prejudice. The way the Torah presents this is to show you that there are not just strangers, but there are members within our own group who need this kind of support system. It's interesting because growing up in England, one of the great achievements that you learn about in school is what they call the welfare state. I think we're talking about after the Second World War, when things really sort of became the National Health Service started, the socialized medicine, etc. And this was always considered a very major achievement. I think the welfare state is earlier than that, if my memory serves me. But of course it does create the dilemma, I suppose, of, you know, passing the buck, as they say. In other words, instead of this being an issue which I have to deal with personally, you know, there's a government agency to deal with it. And I suppose this is the same in every sort of Western country that, you know, sort of around the world that has this infrastructure, but it's challenging. And of course, in the Jewish world, what is so incredible is the fact that as a community, we've never ever shied away from taking these responsibilities, not only for our own people, but even for others. There's a Hatzolah story, a phenomenal story in London, that the Hatzolah ambulance in the one neighborhood there, in Golders Green, I think it was going along on Shabbat. They'd been called out and someone was being taken or had been taken back from their home to the hospital. And as they were going back to where the ambulance was being kept, there was somebody laying on the road. And either they'd been knocked down or they'd had a heart attack or something. And the ambulance, the Hatzolah ambulance, happened to be there. And they stopped. And they literally, Tchiyat Amitim, the guy would have died otherwise. And his attitude afterwards, well, who were you guys? You know, who sent you? You know, Jesus sent you. This is what he told them. They didn't want to quite go that far, but you know what I'm saying. And it made a very big impression in the local community. The newspapers were all over it. Tremendous Kiddush Hashem. And again, this is part of what we do as a Jewish community. We know we go to Haiti, and the first people there are the Israeli field hospitals, and this has been true now for many, many years. And it's an incredible social conscience that we have coming right out of our tradition. As I said over here, no accident that the Jews are in the forefront of the most most civil rights movements in the 60s. The pictures have just been circulating yet again. Avraham Yeshua Heschel, together with Luther King. I actually heard Heschel once in London. His brother was my Rav in London. Very, very interesting. Hasidic dynasty that he came from. Where he went off the rails a little bit, I'm not quite sure. He was a great Talmud Chacham and a magnificent speaker. And the reason why I remember it so clearly, he came for a simcha and they gave him the pulpit. I don't think they realized who he was, because if they'd known he was at JTS, they probably would not have given him the pulpit, but they did, in respect of the rabbi of the shul. And our rabbi had the Polish accent right to the end. He always spoke about the 13 principles of face. I thought it was something to do with makeup, but it was apparently to do with belief, principles of faith. Along comes his brother, this Rabbi Heschel from New York, magnificent speaker. He's actually on YouTube. You can hear some of his, there's an interview with him. Unbelievable. Absolutely, it was overwhelming, I think, you know, and the content was incredible. Never forget, you know, you hear someone like that once, it really made an impression. And we didn't know, I didn't know at the time, and I don't think many people did know his resume, as it were, you know, what exactly he'd been getting up to, apart from teaching in various places, and it's really quite extraordinary. So I remember that, and that again, I think, is part of who we are. Just said at the bottom here on the second page, talking about the ger, what exactly we're referring to, and as we said before, not just the convert, but we're talking about strangers within our society. And again, this is why we're referring to Egypt, because in Egypt we were gerim, we were strangers in that society, and that becomes the raison d'etre for us to look after the stranger in our society, right? And again, we're talking about Jewish society, which, when these comments written by Rambam and Sefer Chinuch were written, they couldn't imagine essentially the Jewish society that we have today. But in Israel, we do have this. And we have these issues, and we have to deal with these issues. In one of the presentations, please God, in a few weeks' time, we'll talk about triage. And I'm talking about triage not in the medical sense, though. It's sort of connected there as well. The whole idea of scarce resources, and, you know, many people want to use the money. What do you? How do you decide where the money goes? And this, again, is part of what this whole discussion sort of develops into, in terms of how we decide how to use our resources. You know, the Federation will come along and say, we're making an appeal for an earthquake situation. You know, how do we deal with that? And all these kind of issues, which again are discussion points and come up sort of now seemingly quite regularly. Look at this Rambam. It's on the third page. Very interesting. All of these sources are fascinating. And the Rambam says like this. It's the third side of the hand. I should have put numbers. Anything I forgot to do here, I apologize. Rambam, it says like this, and it's the Hebrew section near the top of the page. Ezehu ger tosha. Now we've got a, as I said, the word ger is very, very wide ranging, and there's something called ger tosha. And ger tosha means it's someone who lives in Israel and doesn't become Jewish, but it's someone who accepts the basic tenets of the seven laws of Noah. He's a, how shall we say, he's a monotheist, he goes by the practices of the Noahide laws, doesn't murder, doesn't steal, most of those things one doesn't do anyway, but he's got to establish courts of law. There's a whole range of things that the person has to do, and in terms of our relationship to such a person, it's really significant. And it says like this, the Rambam says it, Ezu ger toshav, Zakum, this is a non-Jew, Shekibel alav, Shelo yavod, Akum, he's not going to serve idols, Im Sha'ar mitzvot, Shenistavu b'nei Noah, along with the other six rules, which are the rules of Noahites. Velo mal, velo taval, and he hasn't done Brit Milah, and he hasn't gone to the mikvah, so he's not converted. Hare ze mekablim oto, we accept him in our circle, right? In other words, we do not reject him just because he's not one of us, as they say. And he can be one of the righteous members of the non-Jews in the world. If you go to Yad Vashem, I hope many of you, if not all of you, have been there, you know this tremendous thing that they have when you drive up there, or you walk up there, all the different dedications to the Chassidei Umot Olam people who saved Jews in World War II. A lot of those stories have not come out yet. They're coming out slowly. Surprisingly, sir. There's a whole movement at the moment, Remember Me, or there's something, if you have Facebook, you'll see there's all different things coming from the World Jewish Congress about remembering. There's a big concern that as time goes on, unless survivors are around to tell their story, then the Rishayim, the wicked people out there who deny the Holocaust, will just get away with it. And they're making a lot of effort to bring that message to the wider world. So I just saw something recently, so it's been coming through. So again, Chassidei Umot Olam, this is really important. And he says, V'lama nikra shemo toshav. So why is he called toshav? If he's a dweller, what does that mean? Lefi shemutal lana lo shifo beineinu be'eretz Yisrael. He can dwell in Israel. In fact, Rav Kook, very interestingly, was asked once, what is the status of the Arab in Israel today? What is the Arab's religious status from the point of view of Judaism? And his argument was that they're monotheists, they're probably more monotheistic than we are, right? You know, you go to a mosque, there's no decorations, everything is plain can be. And he said that as far as he was concerned, they have the status of ger toshav. You have to essentially work and respect and try and build a relationship, right? Which again, I thought was very, it's particularly in the days when Rav Kook was functioning in the pre 1948, he died in 1935. So he was dealing with Palestine in those days. It's a remarkable thing that he said. And
What are the laws of Noah?
Essentially, it's really
murder?
Mainly in the negative. Not murdering, not stealing, not committing adultery, not blaspheming, not worshipping idols. There's another
Eber
one, which is... Eber Menachai, not to eat a limb from a living animal. That was being kind to animals, basically. And the positive one, to set up courts of law. As somebody put it once very, very bluntly, to become Jewish for most non-Jews is a liability, because being a non-Jew, you've got seven mitzvot. You become Jewish, 613. You know, that's not a good deal. That is really not a good deal. Seven, wow, that's it. And you're sitting at the top table with Moshe Rabbeinu and Noam Hamad. We're not denying the world to come to anybody, right? They speak to the Baptists, they don't believe that. They say, if you don't believe in JC, you're not being let in. As far as we're concerned, everyone is welcome, provided that they have this awareness of what they meant to do. And they may not be on the same, I don't think they'll be the same table as Moshe Rabbeinu. It'll be in the same room. It'll be sort of, you know, at the end of the room, but they'll be there. It's quite remarkable. And that in itself is an amazing Jewish tradition.
Is there a rationale given?
Sorry?
The first discussion you had was about the reason that we would look after a gear, because they're disadvantaged.
We were
disadvantaged, and so we have to remember them. The second one, it has nothing to do with disadvantage. They're just different, and they're living amongst us.
Correct.
So the commandment or the idea of treating everyone kindly, is this... What is it connected with?
Next quote, and look at this, and this is my blade. You've made the segue into the next quotation. Listen to this, brilliant. And it's a Tanchuma in Lech Lecha. Listen to this. Rabotena Amru, Chaviv Hu Hager, talking about the person we're talking about, the stranger who lives amongst us, the Ger Toshav, Shechtiv HaKadosh Baruch Hu Atzmo, that God said about, or wrote about himself, Lamat... Tiyek ger ba'aretz, Omar Kodesh Baruch Hu, kach ani mechavev et hager, v'Avraham av hagerim. So it goes back essentially to who we are in our tradition from the days of Abraham. Abraham started with gerim, he started bringing people closer to God, and that becomes the rationale for people who make that effort to become ger toshav, not just the stranger amongst us, but they come towards us in terms of understanding the seven Noahide laws. They are more beloved, it says, essentially by God than maybe. I mean, I'm not finishing the sentence because it's not quite clear who is referring to, but it's quite unbelievable, right? In other words, sincerity is really what we're getting at, and it goes right to the heart of where we come from. I don't know if that answers your question, but you see what we're trying to say here.
It's not missionized.
This is not, no, no.
But you're saying you're not trying to promote Judaism.
No.
But if it's, is it Orla Goyim for the purpose of them being more...
I'm going to do a little time out here, because we, historically, and this is something, again, I'm not going to talk about a lot, but once upon a time, we were very missionary. We really were evangelical, right? In Rome, if you go through the history of the Roman Jewish community, we were standing on street corners in Rome preaching Judaism to the Roman world, right, when we were allowed to. And there's a lot of history, a lot of proof about this. And the only reason why we stopped doing it is because the Christians caught on, and they became very evangelical. And then the Jews, you know, as Krizelzach, you know, when they do what they do, we do the opposite. And we started sort of closing ranks. But there's a very interesting suggestion that, not just suggestion, I mean, I think it's found in many... of the sort of, you know, like Josephus and all these sort of writings, that there was this essence of trying to spread the word out there once upon a time. Today we're not famous for doing this anymore. Okay, but once upon a time we really were evangelical, which came as a bit of a surprise when I read about it. And there's more to say. You'll have to Google that and sort of follow that particular piece of information.
Aren't we supposed to discourage?
Nowadays, yeah, we've gone the other direction. And that really came out of Talmud, and it was a Talmudic tradition. But before that even, that, because remember, Talmud is the year 500. We're talking about the year 100, 150, 200, the Common Era. We were really out there doing some very positive evangelical stuff. And there is evidence for this, and it came as a surprise. And I did a whole course on this, and I haven't got my material with me, but I'd have to show you some sources for this, because it really, never expected to see that in our tradition, but it was there. We have a good product to sell, but it's not an easy product. As I said, seven mitzvot, 613. It's not easy to sell the sort of the balance between the two. Yeah.
So when the term kibbutz was used, does that imply only to Jews?
Well, nowadays I would say yes, when we're talking about kibbutz today.
Right.
On the other hand, you know, there are non-Jews that I don't think would call it kibbutz, but we certainly would call it some sort of embracing them if they want to find out more about Judaism. The statistic in Israel, I think, may still be true. The country which provides the largest number of converts in Israel today, where are they coming from? Of all places, is Germany, which is really, really interesting.
Yeah, right.
Right? And again, out of conscience, who knows what, a million and one different reasons. My wife's uncle, Lava Shalom, who was in Kibbutz Lavi, ran a course 10, 12 times a year for converts, and they would be there for like 2 or 3 weeks at a time. And I asked him once, I said, his name was Pumi, I said, Pumi, where do these guys come from? He said, you'd be amazed, mainly from Germany. And of course, he originally was from Germany. He was on the Kinder transport when he came out and spoke fluent German. So he was the obvious guy to, and he was a wonderful man. I mean, you know, if you became Jewish with him, you got a good taste of what Judaism was about. We don't call that Kira, but I guess you could, you know, you might sort of expand it a little bit. You'd have to speak to your local Chabad rabbi about that.
One of my colleagues was in Germany for a year, and she spent time in Simchat Torah in a shul.
Oh, now
and
it's
everybody
staggering.
Was called something Ben Avraham, something yeah. Ben Bat
yeah.
Zara.
Yeah.
Which is, what is this? Everybody's Ben Avraham,
yeah.
Ben Zara.
Yeah.
They're all converts.
Yeah, it's converts. And the whole situation in Germany today, particularly with the Russian Jews who come to Germany, on top of that, is staggering. There's 100,000 Jews in Berlin today, which was unheard of. Till 20 years ago, nobody dreamed of that. So there's a lot of stuff going on in Europe, which I think is, again, for another time. All right, I just want to get to one or two points, because we're going to cover, if you just turn over to the next page. I was reminded here of a story I witnessed, the comment of the Rambam Hilchot Melachim. And the Rambam says like this, and it's the Hebrew paragraph again. I'll just go through it very quickly. Shnei akum shebo lefanecha ledun b'dinei Yisrael. You've got two non-Jews. They want to come to the Jewish court. It may happen. And v'rotzu shneihem ledun din Torah. And they want to have a din Torah. They want to have some sort of judgment. So donin, you do it. Ha'echad rotzu v'echad eino rotzu ein kofin oso ledun. In other words, ela b'dinei. If one does want the Jewish law and the other one doesn't, then you say to them, look, you know, don't want to get involved. Stick to your particular set of principles of laws, and that's what the Rambam says. Now, v'chein yireli shenogim im gerei toshav b'derech eretz gmilah chasadim, and he's saying that if people have committed themselves to live amongst us as ger toshav, as these, I suppose I would call them partial converts. That's what I'm going to call them. Then ki Yisrael, you treat them like they are Jews, meaning sharei onu mitzuvim lachiyotam, we have to give them ability to sustain themselves, parnasah, whatever. Shneamar lager sheh b'sherechet inana v'achola, v'zeh shem chachamim ein kofleim shalom ba'akum v'lo beget toshav filo akum tzivu chachamim levaker choleim. You have to go and make sure that you visit the sick. You don't leave them if they're living amongst, in the Jewish society, or in those days, what we would call the ghetto. Nowadays, we can talk about the state of Israel. We have an obligation to make sure that the burial takes place when it has to take place. In Meitei Yisrael, even if it's with the Jews in the Jewish cemetery, they have a section for non-Jews. There's a whole famous cemetery in Yerushalayim, where Prince Philip, I think his mother's buried there, if I'm not mistaken, in Jerusalem, if I am...
There is
something about that. I don't know whether he's been there, but Charles, I think, went to visit on one of his trips to Israel, which he wasn't allowed to do officially, but he still went. And you have to look after their poor. I'm just reminded of the story. My Rosh Hashiva, Leib Lopian, who died very young man. He was in his mid-60s. He smoked like a chimney. Lithuanian rabbi, they all smoke. And he got lung cancer, Nebuch, and he was very, very sick. And he had a lot of treatments. And once he was coming out of whatever treatment he was having in a hospital in Newcastle, in the north of England, and I happened to be visiting Gateshead at the time, it was after I left the yeshiva, with a friend, and we had a car. So the reverend said, "Will you go and pick up my husband?" So we said, "Sure." So we went to pick him up, and he was sitting on the bed, dressed rabbinically, as the rabbis do, black hat and the whole works. And we went and we asked, "Is Rosh Yeshiva ready to come home?" He said, "Can you give me 2 more minutes? So we said, "As much time as you need." The next thing that happened was remarkable. This was a Victorian hospital. Victorian hospital was 20 beds in a room. Pretty grim, to put it mildly. Who was in this room? It was lung disease, so it was minors, right? You can't imagine the non-Jewish minors about as working class as it gets. And literally, the Rosh Yeshiva went from one bed to the next to wish every person in that room well. He wished them in his broken English. He never really spoke English well, but he just wished them refuah shleima or whatever he said in English. And you could see the persons, you know, that every one of those guys who may have been, before he spoke to them, sort of a bit, you know, sort of living in that circumstance, they perked up a bit. And it was just something to see. And we asked him afterwards, we said, "Kvod HaRav, you know, what happened here?" And he said, "Look," he says, "they all know I'm a rabbi. And they all expect, as a clergyman would, some sort of words of encouragement from the clergy. It doesn't matter whether it's the non-Jewish clergy or the Jewish man. And I just did what I felt was the right thing to do." And for him, it was obvious. To us, we were just sitting there, we were gaping. It was kind of embarrassing, I think, in a way, because it was just something to see. There's something about the Jews that came, particularly from the Haim. They understood that, you know, Yiddishkeit is much more about the interaction, not only between Jew and Jew, which is a whole subject to itself, but, you know, how to relate to the non-Jewish world. And this was a lesson. This was a lesson for life, just to witness that. I mentioned it to his son, who I was very close to in London. He said, "That's my father." He says that, you know, there was no discussion. He wasn't even surprised to hear that he'd done such a thing. But wow, it was something to see. One or two things I want to talk about just over here. You've got all the various sources. The time is against us. I can't go through everything here. I want to talk about this thing of the black Jew, because that is so interesting. We've got racial issues. One of the things living here, we just came up to 20 years. And it's. I suppose it's something which, you know, I'd obviously read about and I'd been aware of sort of what had gone on in the 60s, and then the Crown Heights business early 1990s and what happened there. And, you know, the fact that racism still is an issue in this country, and unfortunately I think it is still a major issue in the country, is something which is a bit surprising, a bit shocking. And by contrast, just look at the use of the term which we use in Hebrew, the word kushi or the word shachor, whatever it may be, in terms of the Jewish attitude to the word black. Very, very interesting. There's a Mishnah Bechorot, and it says, Akushi v'achigeh v'alabkana, these all different so-called blemishes, right? It says that tahorim, these are all considered to be tahorim, these are all considered to be not blemishes, as it were. Someone, let's say, for instance, if they're, again, I don't know, somebody converted from the black community and then they have a child, and what exactly would be, there's a Beit HaMikdash and they want to do something connected to that. I'm not quite sure exactly the hechatims of the situation here, but it's I wrote it in English. A black person cannot be a Kohen as he's not descended from Aaron, so you can't actually become a Kohen. But he is certainly considered Jewish, as is seen from the Mishnah about Tzarat on a black person, where we say here, this is the second quote here, that it says, I haven't got the whole quote here, but it basically saying that in such a circumstance, you know, once you're converted from the black community, you're Jewish, and there's no discussion about it. There's a wonderful guy I keep meeting at Obsedic in the city, who is lives on the Upper West Side, who is a convert from the black community, and really a mainstay of about 2 or 3 shuls in that particular neighborhood. It's quite amazing. This is my favorite quote. The chief rabbi in Israel sanctioned the Ethiopian Olim as Jews, right? That's been a whole discussion to itself. And When they arrived in 1984, the 14,000 that came, it was the first time that black people had been taken from Africa to be free in another country. Right? I just like that quote. That's a very famous quotation. And of course, you've even got the Gemara here from Moed Cotton, where it talks about the idea of the color black being something which represents beauty, represents, you would say in Yiddish, bechent. And just give you one example here, which is this Gemara in the middle of that page. Our Divrei Kush Ben Yamini talks about a certain character called Kush, and the Gemara asks, Vichi Kush Shemov Alo Shaul, it's talking about Shaul, King Saul. So why is he called Kush? Kush means someone from the land of Ethiopia. So what is it referring to? Elama Kushi Meshune Be'oro, just as a person who is of dark skin is different in terms of his skin to the people around him, let's say to the white, then he says, Av Shaul Meshune Be'masav, it's a sign of distinction, of difference, in the sense of someone who is very praiseworthy in his deeds. And Kiyosi B'davar Tomer, Alodot Isha Kushit. Remember, there's a whole thing with Moshe Rabbeinu. It says he married Isha Kushit. Right? The whole expression there. And the rabbis are very perplexed because Isha Kushit, she wasn't Ethiopian, she was Midianite. So what's it referring to if it's referring to Tzipora? And again, the idea of the use of the term Kushi, of the color, is to show the beauty of the person. Right? So in terms of Jewish sources, the whole use of a pejorative in terms of color is something which is anathema. It's not there. It's just it never appeared.
Then why does it say a black person can't be a Kohen?
Well, again,
what Aaron was.
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's, again, we're talking here presumably about someone who's converted, and for lots of sort of very good reasons, unless you have some sort of history of the person from before, and there have been cases like that. Right, I'm not saying that this is a definite.
Right, so why say a black person? Why not say someone who converted?
Yeah. But again, specifically talking about the color black in terms of someone coming into the community from the black community converting. There are shuls. There were a number of shuls, I think, in Harlem where this there was, you know, sort of a number of communities, as far as I know, and there are in Israel as well. That in itself was just something that I wasn't so concerned with the law of the Kohen part, but the fact that, you know, someone coming in from the community of whatever it may be, from what we call in the Hebrew Kushim, is not considered a pejorative definition by any means whatsoever. Just want to make that clear. In fact, the Ethiopians in Israel have been an absolute, not just a breath of fresh air, I think it's more than that. There's just something about the Ethiopian Jew which is very, very special. I had a student at Stern, I might have mentioned this, that she told me she was going to be away for 2 weeks in Israel. This was around Purim time. And I said, obviously missing school. So I said, what was going on? So she said her brother's getting married. She was from I think, Michigan or Cleveland. I think she was Cleveland. And I said, oh, that's very nice, and who's he marrying? So she showed me a picture, and it's an Ethiopian girl. And I'm looking at this and saying, that's going to be an interesting wedding. You know, that will be one worth going to see. And I made a promise to bring back photos. And it was so beautiful. You know, she came back and she was crying about it. She said, this was just one of the most amazing experiences of kibbutz goliot that you could ever imagine. I mean, you can't even describe it without having been there, but I saw the photos and it really made an impression. The last page, and I just want to sort of tie this all up, is there one area where we can be prejudicial? As I said before, maybe in terms of certain groups of people that the Torah warns us about, that they are just people we do not want amongst us for the reasons that the Torah gives. For instance, it says Ammoni and Moavi Asurim, right? The Ammonite and the Moabite. Because they were people who were not doing what they should have done, from the point of view of humanity. We were traveling, we needed help, we needed assistance, and they didn't help us. So that became a blot on them forever and ever. So again, if we're talking about prejudice, that may be the one area where we are warned, as it were, let's be careful with those groupings, not to have them amongst us because of the negative effect that person can have. As we know the famous phrase, as it says over here, Let's just see
what,
one second.
What does it mean, neka votehen, the females?
Yeah, yeah. The whole thing was, again, because there was an allowance with Ruth that she was of the... Uh-huh. The men were forbidden, but the women were allowed. So even there was an allowance that was made. But again, it won't be sort of something done easily. Nowadays, of course, we don't know who the Moabites and the Ammonites are anymore, so we can't even talk about this. But in terms of Princeton, I found a story when I originally made this particular shiur, put it together. There was a group of people, I think from Russia, living in Israel who were, in fact, neo-Nazis. I don't even remember that story. It was about 7 or 8 years ago. And it really was a strange, strange group of people who were living in Israel, of all places, and were, you know, flying the flags and having all these kind of very extreme meetings and stuff that was going on. And again, the Israeli... the police and whatever were having a big problem. What to do with these guys, right? They'd come out of Russia, I guess, but had not in any way embraced or left behind all the, you know, sort of anti-Semitism that they'd taken with them. And they weren't Jews, right? A lot of the people came out of Russia were not Jewish, and we know that's been a problem in general. We want to, as I said at the bottom here, the rule. It is not the person, but the values that are represented that the Torah is against. If a person represents certain negative values, that's where we are told, be careful, maybe to the point of prejudice, but in a sense of self-protection. Right? And again, once a non-Jew accepts the seven Noachide laws, then he is accepted, because his lifestyle, even though his lifestyle is still different, his values are now in line with Jewish concepts. And I think this is really where we are coming from and what we are saying. Final comment, prejudice, because I'm looking at the time, it's a lot of stuff to get through, and I'm sorry, it's probably maybe too much. Prejudice is clearly contrary to Judaism, one may never discriminate. That's the bottom line, right? Even though I said just now there might be an allowance, but it's not something that we're comfortable with. The Jewish anti-Semite has always been a problem for us. That's one of the areas where we do have a problem, and BDS and everything else that's going on. Mentioned again this week, interestingly, of all things to talk about, when... the vice president spoke to the Knesset. I think he was introduced by Netanyahu as someone who had worked very hard against BDS. And this is something that certainly in Israel they are very aware of. In this country, I don't know, if you're on the campuses, you know about it, but otherwise, not so much. And it's a serious problem. And a lot of Jewish kids are getting swept up in it. There is even a young man who wrote a piece in the Columbia Spectator, just to sort of share with you something that just came out recently, where he has just come back from a birthright trip and has been so influenced by the BDS movement that everything he saw in Israel, he twisted around to use as propaganda against Israel, even though he went on a birthright trip. In other words, you know, you bit the hand that fed you. It was unreal. And in fact, this young man, I wish I could find who he is to sit him down and talk to him and talk a bit of sense. You know, why did you go with such a closed mind? Because he didn't, you know, he says, I saw certain things, but... you know, I'm still worried about the poor Palestinian. And it's very strange. It really is a mindset which is something which is very difficult to deal with and is a very big challenge. You know, the bottom line we're saying here, we may discriminate only against individuals who represent alien values to our own and pose a spiritual or physical threat thereby, otherwise totally unacceptable. And of course, the lesson of the Shoah, which is what I spoke about at the beginning, and I think this is always going to be the lesson, a Jew is a Jew is a Jew. You know, for us to sort of find other Jews, you know, sort of to be against them because maybe they're not so religious or they're not so, you know, Ashkenazim, Sephardim, and all the other, you know, myriad of differences that we seem to invent between our own people. All of this is a function, unfortunately, of really the opposite of what we're saying here. The idea is of recognizing the shared values, recognizing the shared identity, the shared covenant, as Jonathan Sachs talks about a lot, the covenantal relationship that we have to each other. And in the end of the day, I think that's the big lesson of the Shoah, is to understand what we've got in common much more than what we are, where we are differing. And of course, I think that's maybe an obvious comment, but I think it's important to be stressed. Not an easy subject to talk about, right? Prejudice for Jews, meaning that we should act in a prejudicial way, not an easy subject to discuss, and clearly something which, as I know, and as I said at the beginning, speaking to an older generational group, there was a little sense of discomfort there, because I think they all remember the kind of prejudicial language that maybe they grew up with in the home, you know, talking about black people or talking about people that they lived in their different communities. And, you know, nowadays, I think, thank God, I think the Jewish world has maybe changed for the best. I think that language is not quite with us as it used to be. I'll leave it at that. Any comments? Any questions? Difficult subject. Yeah.
Tangential question. Suppose you're Jewish and you work for the government of the United States.
Yeah.
And you were asked to comment upon the change in the Medicaid laws, requiring people to work, which is happening right now.
Oh, wow.
As a Jewish person, you have a faith, but you also have an obligation to the government.
Yeah.
So you have a conflict there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there any halakhic sources of
how to deal
with that?
Yeah, and that's when we get around the second time around, we'll come to Dina de Malchuta.
Yeah.
That there has to be a not just an awareness of it, but a sensitivity towards the law of the land, right? And that becomes a religious obligation. In fact, we will talk about it in a few weeks, because I'm talking about Xerox copyright, and that's where that whole discussion comes. And it would be connected to your question as well. You can't ignore the obligation that you have in terms of where you're living, the country that you're living in. But the problem will be when it becomes conflicting. If you live in Russia and they say you've got to go to school on Shabbat, that's where Dina Malchuta becomes very challenging. And a lot of Russian Jews who were becoming religious did go to work or to school, but they went on the subway. They sewed their ticket into the lapel of their jacket. And I saw that when I was in Russia. I couldn't believe it. Right? Somebody put it to me, in America, doing that would not be the greatest thing to do. In Russia, you're a tzaddik gomor. You're greater than who knows who, because you sewed your ticket into the lapel. Amazing stories that were going on there. So it's a big topic. Thank you for the question. I haven't given you a great answer, but to be continued. Yeah?
I just made a comment. I may have mentioned that another time to you. But, you know, we say we've kind of gotten rid of the prejudice in the Jewish community towards blacks, or maybe the language has changed.
I hope we have.
But I just, you know, just for... I don't see it.
Yeah.
And a very nice man on my street, who doesn't live there anymore, said to me, called me over, and I was friendly with him, and we were talking, and he was in my sukkah, and he answered. He said, can I ask you a question? He said, how come Jewish people don't acknowledge that I exist? He said, they walk on the street, or something.
But he's talking about our neighborhood.
Our neighborhood. He lived in the Gals house before he moved away. He was a really nice guy.
Yeah.
And very educated. And he said, I'm working out, walking out, I'm outside. The people, the religious-looking people, walk past me.
Right.
They don't look at me. They look away or they'll cross the street. He said, and no one acknowledges the fact that, he said, it's very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
He said, could you explain why that is?
Yeah, and your point is taken on board. I can only say that.
But this is just
I can only say the converse.
You just need to go to Brooklyn for one.
And unfortunately,
you will see.
I was afraid that this was going to come out. I didn't want to go there. I can only say to you, I work with a lot of West Indian guys. I learned a lot of people from the Caribbean. And my greatest accolade at the moment, I'm known as Brother Rabbi. And Brother Rabbi means I've really made it. And it's not. They're not jiving me. They really do. Because we have a relationship. We really, and bottom line is, we have the same issues, a lot of the same issues, you know, family and worrying about all the things that we all worry about. It's I think more rabbis need to talk about this. That's the bottom line. I really
had
do.
I this argument because I was in Brooklyn.
It's
recently,
just how they refer.
And it's often, there's a real problem there. But the argument I propose to them, I say, I don't know why you're doing this, because most likely you're going to have a black caretaker. And that's probably the last person you're going to see before you leave this world.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
I think there needs to be more in this kind of conversation. You know, that's what I was kind of asking. There's the issue of, you know, if you're under privilege, we have the obligation to look out for someone who's less fortunate.
Right.
But some of this has nothing to do with less fortunate. Some of this is just
human
xenophobia. Lack of familiarity and insularity,
right.
And you know,
right.
but it doesn't reflect well on us. It's not Jewish value.
Right. Well, again, you know, look at the sort of you know, that iconic picture of Heschel with Luther King, and that kind of, you know, and there are role models out there, you know, to to raise the game, as it were, but I think you're right. I think you're right. I don't want to end on a downer, so as I said, Brother Rabbi, remember that. It's a great comment. Next.
I brought the guy to Mincha, by the way.
Sorry?
I brought him to Mincha. The guy from the neighborhood.
Oh, really?
Oh,
nice. Yeah. Good for you. Good for you. Good for you. Ah, now you've—that's it. Now you've struck gold. Be'ez Hashem, next time we're doing, as I said, Q, Queen and Country, to be continued. Until next week. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.